On this week's program, we listen back to an interview with Mari Yoshihara, author of Musicians from a Different Shore. Jason Pfeiffer visits the DeMuth Museum in Lancaster. David Patrick Stearns looks back on the 100-year history of the Grand Pipe Organ in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. And Susan Lewis takes a walk through Rhythms of India, the Art of Nandalal Bose, an exhibition currently at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Musicians from and of Asian descent are ubiquitous in the world of Western classical music. A significant presence in music schools, professional ensembles, and as concert soloists. How Eastern culture came to embrace Western music is the subject of a new book, Musicians from a Different Shore. Its author, Mari Yoshihara, is now an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, but began studying piano in her native Japan at the age of 3, a practice common among middle-class households in the last part of the 20th century. In her book, Yoshihara combines historical research with personal interviews of contemporary Asian and Asian American musicians to present both a comprehensive study of the intersection of culture, race, and music, and an intimate glance into the human stories behind the trends. It's obvious to anybody who goes to classical music concerts or who buys classical music recordings these days that there is a huge amount of Asian and Asian American musicians. Tell us the history of how we've got to this situation.
Well, this is, depending on how you see it, you can see it as a recent phenomenon or a more historical phenomenon. I would say that the noticeable increase in the number of Asians and Asian Americans in classical music, maybe about the last 2 or 3 decades. But there is a long history that led up to it, from the introduction of Western music to Japan, China, and Korea from the late 19th and early 20th century. And, you know, those three nations made very programmatic efforts to make it a very central part of their culture, very much led by the government and then also pushed by the middle class, aspiration for middle class. So there's a long history leading up to it. And especially after the end of World War II in Japan and after Korean War in Korea, after the Cultural Revolution in China, it became a very widely middle class phenomenon for the people there to pursue classical music. So that's sort of the historical and social basis for this recent phenomenon.
And this was about looking west and saying what? What were people saying about the West that convinced them that classical music was something that children should learn?
I would say initially, in the early part of the 20th century, it was classical music was associated definitely with Western modernity. And so the aspiration to become bourgeois middle class was kind of the central economic and social pull for Asians. But one of the things that I'm trying to say in the book is that it became a lot more than that, especially in the last 2 or 3 decades. I would say that for most Asians in Asia today, classical music is not necessarily seen as something specifically European or even Western. It's a very central part of their own culture. And so they don't necessarily, especially the musicians who are pursuing it, they don't necessarily think of it as something, they're doing something foreign or Western. It's just, you know, part of their lives and their identity.
You're not writing from a totally uninvolved point of view. Mm-hmm. You yourself went through this phenomenon, having your parents encourage you to take up a musical instrument.
More than encourage.
Okay. I was putting it as nicely as possible. What word should I use?
Push.
Okay. Your parents pushing you to take up a musical instrument.
Yeah.
The parental influence shouldn't be understated in this because amongst Asians, and I don't want to make a broad sweeping statement, but there would appear to be a greater respect and a greater desire to please one's parents in the East than there is in the West. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a generalization, but I think, you know, there's some truth to, you know, those kinds of generalizations. And I mean, because for people who become professional musicians, they really have to start serious training by age 5 or 7 at the latest. And, you know, most kids don't choose to, you know, do rigorous study of classical music at such an early age. I mean, most people start, you know, because their parents want them to, and then especially in Asia, there's stronger emphasis on kind of regimented training, both in practice and lessons. And so that's very central to the way in which these musicians are trained and disciplined, really.
They say the last century was America's century, and this will be China's or Asia's century. Can you foresee a situation when the US and Europe will not be the meccas to which these musicians are drawn, and that you will have orchestras of significant standing in, for instance, China? You already have in Japan, but, but more so in China.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, the introduction of Western music to Asia is not simply kind of a one-way street from West or, say, Europe to Asia. Like, for instance, a lot of Chinese and Korean musicians in the early 20th century, they went to Japan to study, not Europe or the United States, because it was more feasible economically, geographically, and whatnot. And so even today, like in a lot of Japanese orchestras, there are, you know, musicians from other parts of Asia, you know, working there. And so, you know, I can totally see, like, 10, 20 years from now, like, you know, Shanghai Symphony or, you know, Beijing Orchestra, they would be like real players in the world of classical music worldwide.
Maria Shahara, Musicians from a Different Shore, is published by Temple University Press.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Born in 1883, the American painter Charles DeMuth generated about 1,000 works over the course of his lifetime. Yet while long recognized as a master watercolorist, his name has never carried much star power in his hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. But since his death in 1935, that's been slowly changing. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, a foundation and museum in downtown Lancaster continues to celebrate the life and works of this innovative painter.
The DeMuth Foundation and Museum was founded by the now 94-year-old Jerry Less, a former local journalist and longtime Lancaster resident. Less says he became conscious of the work of Charles DeMuth in the mid-1930s, while a student at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
I used to read Vanity Fair and a couple of other magazines of that type, and he was featured as a national, at that time, known artist. And it occurred to me that nobody in Lancaster knew about this man who was known throughout the country.
When he later moved back to Lancaster, Less found there were no DeMuth paintings on public exhibition anywhere in town. For years, this bothered Less, so in the early 1980s, he spearheaded an initiative to raise funds for the creation of a dedicated DeMuth Museum. The first order of business was purchasing one of the oldest buildings in Lancaster, the artist's King Street home and studio, where DeMuth lived for most of his life and died. This became the museum's home. In the beginning, Less says the foundation did not own any DeMuth artwork, but the donations soon came.
My wife at that time, Margaret, gave Charles's self-portrait, which she had bought at an auction sale for $2. So that gives you some idea of Lancaster's knowledge and respect for Charles the painter.
Any idea why that would be the case? That you mentioned that there was a little reluctance or lack of enthusiasm.
When he lived in Lancaster, he was more or less a recluse. He had a few favorite friends, but he did not circulate. His illness contributed to that.
DeMuth's health was perpetually frail. As a child, he suffered from lameness, and as an adult, from severe diabetes. But this didn't stifle his creativity, which his family recognized early on. They hired teachers to help nurture his artistic talent and had the means to do so with a successful family business. Standing alongside the DeMuth home, the DeMuth Tobacco Shop was and still is a popular institution in Lancaster City. Started in 1770, it's the oldest operating tobacco shop in the country. As DeMuth grew older, he received training in Philadelphia at the Drexel Institute of Art, Science, and Industry and at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. He also traveled extensively, which enabled him to foster friendships with early 20th century luminaries like Georgia O'Keeffe, Marcel Duchamp, Gertrude Stein, and Eugene O'Neill. DeMuth Museum Executive Director Ann Lampe says these experiences helped shape DeMuth's artistic vision.
He lived in Lancaster all his life, but traveled in very avant-garde intellectual circles in Philadelphia, New York, London, Paris. He took the most avant-garde ideas of the day, and they were emanating out of Europe, and brought them back to America and applied them to the subject matter of Lancaster and everything he found here.
DeMuth is known for his skillful and imaginative use of watercolors, especially his paintings of flowers from his mother's garden, which he could see from his second-floor studio. DeMuth Museum visitors can explore both the restored garden with its original brickwork and DeMuth's studio space, in which he spent so much time.
Today, you can still see the tile in the gallery, but he came through the bathroom and back in here to his studio, and he was secluded. It had three windows, so he could look out into his mother's garden and the Trinity.
DeMuth is also known for being at the forefront of developing a style of painting known as Precisionism, an art movement strongly influenced by Cubism and often focusing on the industrialization and modernization of the American landscape. For instance, Anne Lampe says DeMuth would take something very commonplace, like a flower.
And he would create planes and lines. If you know Picasso's Cubism, how he creates planes out of everything. And so cutting things into planes and different forms, which are called rays. So it sort of looks like light coming through a stained glass window, cutting across a picture.
Two of DeMuth's most well-regarded paintings were created in this style, the descriptively titled Figure 5 in gold, and My Egypt, which in particular reflects the inspiration that the city of Lancaster provided for DeMuth. The 1927 painting features two once prominent grain towers in downtown Lancaster. Other paintings feature the city's Lutheran church steeple, a feed mill sign, a water tower, and chimneys. Anne Lampe says works like these synthesized what was going on in America at the time.
Here in Lancaster, we forget what a bustling city this was, with the trolleys and the streetcars going up and down and the electricity wires were coming. But yet you could go a half mile and you were in a farm. So he was really exploring this transition in American society between an agrarian culture and becoming an industrialized culture.
Lampe says this exploration made him a leader of early American modernist art, a painter that influenced artists to come, pop artists like Andy Warhol and Robert Indiana. Tom Cook, a Lancaster-based art collector and enthusiast, says in paintings like My Egypt at the Whitney Museum, DeMuth taught so many how to look at mundane things in a fresh way.
The grain towers that were mentioned, I went to the Whitney and I was blown away by his imaging of, you know, things that I took for granted that I drove by every day. And I think that an artist can show us how to see something in a totally new and different light.
Due to the widespread reverence for DeMuth's work today, many of his well-known pieces are on display in galleries and museums outside of Lancaster. But that's not to say that the DeMuth Museum collection is unimportant. With 32 DeMuth pieces, only the Barnes Foundation in Marion, PA, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York feature more of his works. Even so, the strength of the museum in Lancaster is the opportunity to see the house DeMuth called home, the studio in which he created, and the buildings and garden that provided so much inspiration for his paintings. With the Foundation's historical artifacts, library archives, and art collection, DeMuth Museum leaders want to continue developing the institution into being what they call DeMuth Central, a must-see destination for any serious student and admirer of Charles DeMuth. The old adage of the prophet being honored anywhere but in his hometown may at one time have been appropriate for Lancaster, but now the Foundation and Museum that bears his name is helping to ensure that Charles DeMuth is remembered and revered where he was born, lived, and died.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Walking into the great auditorium in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, means entering an era your great-grandparents might have known, if they were beachgoers or Methodist. To your left in this massive structure, designed to seat a 7,000-strong congregation, is a lighted sign that declares, "Holiness to the Lord." To the right, a similar sign adds, "So be ye holy." The ceiling is lined with lights like a Ferris wheel, and a World War I American flag similarly illuminates itself. The focal point, however, is something illuminating the room with music, a pipe organ that's celebrating its 100th birthday this summer with a series of concerts with orchestras and brass ensembles. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered that the organ's history wasn't always glorious, but contains tales of extravagance, neglect, suicide, and, in the name of progress, vandalism.
To understand the Ocean Grove organ is to appreciate the unlikelihood that anything of its size was built here. Ocean Grove was a religious camp by the sea. Some of the structures were, and still are, temporary house-sized tents. Its towering pipe organ was built in 1908 for the then-steep sum of $27,000. Numbers tell part of the story. while Philadelphia's Kimball Center organ has 125 ranks that total nearly 7,000 pipes, the Ocean Grove instrument, which serves a larger auditorium and a more populous function, has 176 ranks totaling 10,823 pipes. In fact, this town has more organ pipes than it has people, twice as many, and then some.
It's very unusual.
The organ's curator, John Shaw, has written a centennial booklet titled The Great Auditorium Organ.
To build an immense organ for use only in the summer months, some individuals would say is kind of over the edge. But this building has had a history of a great music program going all the way back to its inception in 1894. Many of the great opera stars around the turn of the century sang here. Schumann, Hind, and Gallicherchi, and McCormick, and Caruso all were here in Ocean Grove. And eventually it became apparent that a large organ should be built in order to accommodate congregations which were anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people.
The organ builder was an innovative Englishman, Robert Hope Jones, who believed in spending whatever was necessary to create a great instrument and trust that the money would show up somehow. In fact, Ocean Grove probably got twice the organ that it could afford. Hope Jones paid for half of it, hoping to give demonstration recitals for prospective investors in his company. One was Andrew Carnegie, who was quoted as saying he wanted an organ to overwhelm me with the feeling of how miserable a sinner I am. It's not that kind of organ. It's imposing. One of the pipes weighs more than a ton. Resident organist Gordon Turk compares some of the organ sounds to an explosion in a lumber factory. But even uncoached ears hear the instrument's most distinctive aspect, a mellow, often ethereal timbre.
A lot of these sounds are from vintage pipes that we sought particular builders, particularly Ernest Skinner built wonderful instruments in America in the teens, 20s, 30s, up into the 40s. And there are several ranks in here that are from that particular builder, the vintage pipes, and then other new ones that we've had built which are in the same, along the same line. This is a Hope Jones sound, one of the original, very young. It's a very quiet, and this sound he built to go with it. And then we have all these other sounds, a lot of Skinner pipes to add to it that increase the warmth mm-hmm. and, again, the mellowness of the organ. And there also are a lot, there's a higher ratio of wooden pipes in this organ than in many instruments, and that gives additional solidity and warmth to it as well. One of my favorites is the clarinet stop.
Over the decades, the instrument wasn't well maintained, and by 1961, when the famous Virgil Fox came to perform, he was appalled and said so from the stage, recalls curator John Shaw.
And I can remember the quote as well as it were yesterday because I was sitting out in the audience. And if you had driven a 1929 Ford across this country every year between 1929 and the current 1961, what would you need? And the entire audience responded by saying, a new car. And Fox said, exactly. And Ocean Grove needs a new organ.
That was a turning point, but not a good one. Problems were remedied on the cheap and in ways better suited to a small room than a gargantuan auditorium. You never knew what would work, recalls the Philadelphia Orchestra's organist Michael Stairs. The core of the organ repertoire, J.S. Bach, was pretty much out of the question. Gordon Turk arrived in the mid-1970s and started undoing the damage. Valuable pipes were found discarded underneath the auditorium. Other like-minded instruments provided more pieces.
One set of pipes came from the Baptist Temple, which, of course, is the building from which Temple University evolved. And this was a set of pipes that was built by Hope Jones 3 years after he built this organ. And they were taking the organ out, and we were able to purchase the 32-foot diaphone pipes, which is a very low-pitched, fundamental, thunder-shaking stop.
Two years ago, Gordon Turk found another set of pipes that were once part of the Ocean Grove organ in a northern New Jersey garage. An organ enthusiast, planned to build his own instrument but never got around to it. These pipes are back after a 40-year absence. Just this year, an antiphonal extension called an echo was installed in the rear of the auditorium. Even so, Turk says the organ is only two-thirds of what it was. That's hard to envision, but then the Ocean Grove organ arrived at a time of Victorian grandeur. Imagine a sonic counterpart to, oh, Philadelphia City Hall, only tasteful. Others have compared it to a feast of comfort food. Yet the organ supplied little lasting comfort to Robert Hope Jones. Only a few years after his work in Ocean Grove, he suffered a decline not uncommon to great innovators of the early 20th century who couldn't function in competitive business. He might have had a stable, wealthy existence after joining forces with the organ manufacturing Wurlitzer brothers. But even in his best days, Hope Jones was described as an eccentric, and his personality clashed so much with theirs that he was marginalized by the company and sent away with a $50 a week pension. Indeed, Jones was notably absent from a 1914 anniversary gala of the Ocean Grove organ. Instead, he was found dead in a Rochester, New York rooming house. The cause was listed as suicide while insane. Lucky for us, the fruit of his more divine madness still lives and lives loud.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. India was a British colony from 1858 to 1947, and its art during this time reflected the tensions between the indigenous people and their colonial masters. During this period and beyond, the now revered Indian painter Nandalal Bose produced thousands of works which have, until now, largely remained unseen in the Western world. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis visits the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where the first major Nandalal exhibition outside Asia is shedding light on the artist considered to be India's father of modern art.
In the late 1800s and the first half of the 20th century, India was struggling for political independence and a new cultural identity that represented both centuries-old traditions and its desired future as a modern sovereign state. Born into this turbulent cultural climate in 1882, artist and teacher Nandalal Bose would go on to create nearly 7,000 works of fine art during his lifetime, using a range of subjects and techniques, from sketches and prints to colorful murals and paintings to hand-painted political posters and illustrations for the state of India's new constitution. Dariel Mason is curator of Indian and Himalayan art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, now hosting Rhythms of India, the Art of Nandalal Bose. She says Nandalal was an experimenter.
He has been paralleled in some ways to Picasso because he had so many different ways and styles that he could use and that he was fluent in right at the same time.
But it was not the cleverness of trying to experiment with different styles or media.
Supratik Bose, the artist's grandson, grew up in Nandalal's household.
It was more trying to describe many facets of a single thing.
And says the variety in his grandfather's work reflected a spiritual exploration about the joyous nature or rhythms of life.
He believed, and others believed, that it was a joy that started the world. And it's a series of experiments throughout life trying to convey that joy.
As a child, Nandalal showed a particular talent for drawing, and when he was 23, enrolled in Calcutta's School of the Arts, where he studied with Abanindranath Tagore, a teacher who would introduce him to a larger circle of influential artists and thinkers. These included his brother, Rabindranath Tagore, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1913 and founded an international school in rural Bengal. In 1919, Nandalal started the school's art department, where he stayed until his retirement in 1951. Michael Meister, professor of South Asian Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and co-curator of Multiple Modernities, a related Philadelphia Museum show on India's modern art, says that the early 20th century artists were looking to express a national identity that was, well, not British.
They wanted to move away from the economic and cultural domination. And initially, they felt even the material domination of British ways of making art.
Nandalal worked using local materials and colors that could be ground from local pigments, never working in oils that would have had to come from Europe. Meister says that in looking to reflect modernity, instead of turning west, they looked to the east for inspiration.
They felt that they should find roots in an international world, but the international world of Asia is what they felt was appropriate to an Indian contemporary artist.
Nandalal grew up with traditional Indian art depicting religious figures of gods and goddesses. In rural Bengal, he began to paint instead the figures and landscapes of the world around him. Nandalal frequently sketched subjects on 3x5 cards, says his grandson, Supertik Bose, and then went back to his studio to paint.
He did not actually paint the paintings in the presence of that landscape or a person. It's all from memory. It had to be from memory, or else you're distracted by reality, I guess.
His studio at home reflected this meditative approach to making art.
With two glass walls and windows, one wall floor-to-ceiling books, and the fourth wall empty, a low platform on which he sat in Buddha position, surrounded by ink and other things. Coconut shell bowl to hold clear water, a piece of cloth folded, and that was that.
Nandalal created art for the school, for himself, and on commission. Included in this show are the final large preparatory paintings for a major mural cycle from the late 1930s. Philadelphia Museum of Art curator Dariel Mason says Nandalal was the only artist patronized by Mahatma Gandhi, who was drawn to his depictions of ordinary Indian people.
And when Gandhi saw those, he saw these people who were really outcast from mainstream Indian society had been treated with a great deal of dignity and respect and sensitivity. And he asked Nandalal to design the installations for a succession of political happenings that he was having.
Included in the show are some of the hundreds of hand-painted posters with images of villagers which Nandalal produced with local craftsmen.
From a mother feeding her child to a woman cooking to musicians playing, dancers. And this was a way to bring those everyday people of India together with those who were striving for their independence.
Also on display is Nandalal's iconic image of Gandhi and a reproduction of India's National Constitution of 1950, for which Nandalal created the illustrations. In 1951, Nandalal retired from teaching, but until his death in 1955, he continued to paint, mostly monochromatic ink drawings in a Japanese style. Like many of his contemporaries, Nandalal resisted the influences of the West, but he emerged as an artist for whom individual expression in all its variety was paramount. Sonia Quintanilla, curator at the San Diego Museum of Art, which collaborated on this show with India's government and National Gallery of Modern Art, says the key to Nandalal's work is the multiplicity that is unified by a sense of creative joy.
That we call Leela in Hindu thought, which is the nature of the creator's work in the world, and which is essentially one of play and joy. And so that's something that kind of underlies all of his work and kind of distinguishes it from Western modernism.
Nandalal's work, mostly private and created for immediate use, has never been on the international art market. Supertik Bose says that in 1982, he placed the entire 6,780-piece collection with the National Gallery of Modern Art in New Delhi at the request of then-Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who was also a student of Nandalal's. And so we in the West are just beginning to discover this artistic master, who created art as part of a joyous personal journey through the rhythms of life, yet shared it with his students, with everyday people of India, and now with us.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Rhythms of India, the Art of Nandalal Bose, runs through September 1st at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. A related show, Multiple Modernities, India 1905 through 2005, runs through December 7th, also at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.